I hope you've had a really encouraging time too. These weekends are precious. But, and I hate to bring bad news, tomorrow is Monday. Back to work. Back to uni. Back to the real world. Back to difficult colleagues and awkward family relationships. Back to that lecturer who mocks the gospel in her lectures. Or that boss who's dead against you trying to share the gospel at work. Back to news stories that endlessly seem to show Jesus' kingdom going backwards and not forwards. Back to memes on Facebook and articles on BuzzFeed that tell you that Christianity is contradictory, bigoted, unscientific nonsense. Back with a bump. We live in a world where nobody around us thinks that the God of the Bible is in charge. In fact, if we're honest, we live in a world where loads of people hate the idea of the God of the Bible being in charge. And we live in a world where plenty of people and organizations and plenty of other gods claim that they are in charge. And plenty of them seem able to back up that claim with a lot of muscle. So I don't know about you, but I find myself getting what you might call sovereignty amnesia. I forget that God is in charge of the world, and I start to worry that maybe something else is really in charge. Isaiah and his little group of disciples from today's reading had all the same problems as us, but on a grander scale. The vast majority of the people in Judah rejected Isaiah and his message. Society was full of injustice and corruption. Idolatry was everywhere. Judah was invaded twice and nearly destroyed in Isaiah's lifetime. And the message from God was that worse was to come. Isaiah had predicted that the Babylonian Empire would destroy Jerusalem and carry the people away into exile. But in our chapter today, God has sent Isaiah to announce an incredible salvation. Verse 1 sets the tone. These are words of comfort. God is saying that he personally is coming to save them. Look for a moment at verses 10 and 11. Behold, the Lord comes with might, and his arm rules for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his recompense before him. He will tend his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms. He will carry them in his bosom and gently lead those that are with young. But there's evidence all through this section of Isaiah that his disciples are deeply, deeply discouraged. We see it today, I think, probably in verse 27 of our reading most clearly. Everywhere around them, their nation is falling into ruin. And everyone around them is looking to something or someone else to solve the problem. The nations look powerful. The idols look powerful. Everything really, frankly, looks powerful except Isaiah and Isaiah's God. They're getting sovereignty amnesia. So Isaiah doesn't tell us much about how the rescue will work or what it will look like in this chapter. Instead, what he gives most of his airtime to is a good, hard look at the God of the rescue. Because as we grasp who our God really is, we'll have the truths that we need to fight our sovereignty amnesia. At the end of the day, Isaiah's main message here is clear and simple and repeated again and again in our passage. And it's the first point in our handout today. Remember the unrivaled power and wisdom of the Creator God. Remember the unrivaled power and wisdom of the Creator God. Our God is the God who made the entire universe. If you've been a Christian any length of time, that'll be a familiar idea to you. Any Christian knows, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But isn't it easy to forget what that means? Isn't it easy to forget how stunning a fact that is? So Isaiah peppers us with questions to remind us just what an amazing fact it is. This passage is full of these rhetorical questions and striking images to help us form an image of how great and how powerful and how wise our God is. So take verse 12, for example. We have, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? If you cup your hand like that The next time you're at the sink or in the shower, I don't imagine you'll catch too much water in that little kind of cubby hole that you make in your hand. Isaiah says that to God, all the trillions of liters of water in the oceans are just like that little pool of water you make in your hand. It's an image of his unimaginable power. Or later on we get, who has enclosed the dust of the earth in a measure, or weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Maybe it's a reflection of what life in the Yates family is like, but when those sorts of tools come out of the cupboard at home for me, it's baking a cake. If you're a baker, next time you measure out the flour for your latest creation, imagine that little pile of flour. Imagine that's Mount Everest, and you have some small idea of how great God is. My favorite one is probably in verse 26. Lift up your eyes and see. Who created these? He who brings out their host by number, calling them all by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. I did a bit of digging on the internet this week, and while it might not seem like it to you when you lift up your eyes to see here in central London, there's actually an estimated 1 trillion billion stars in the observable universe. That's one with 21 zeros after it, if you don't know how much a trillion billion is. God made each one. God has counted each one. He knows, we sang, didn't we? He knows each one by name. Just to put that in context, if every man, woman, and child on the planet were to count one star per second, then if we did nothing else, round the clock, it would take the entire human race 4,404 years of non-stop counting to count the stars. Again, if we'd started when David became king in 2 Samuel and done nothing else ever since, we'd still have more than 1,000 years of counting left to do now. If God is the God who made the universe, our human minds are just too tiny to grasp how awesome his power and knowledge are. But Isaiah isn't content just to show us God's power through these questions. No, we've not gone far enough until we see that God is completely unrivaled in having this kind of power and greatness. Verse 13 asks us, who has measured the Spirit of the Lord? Or what man shows him his counsel? Well, no one has, and no one does. Whom did he consult? And who made him understand, asks verse 14. Well, nobody. Who taught him the path of justice and taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? Well, obviously, no one did. We get it twice in our passage today, once in verse 18 and once in verse 25. To whom will you liken God? Or with what likeness compare with him? Nobody comes even close. But just so we're sure, Isaiah gives us a look at some of the contenders. These are the guys Isaiah's disciples attempted to look at as though maybe they were in charge. Maybe they fear them as potential destroyers, or maybe they're tempted to trust them as potential saviors. First, we get a look at the nations. Isaiah's disciples live in a world of increasingly powerful and increasingly brutal superpowers, empires that seem to sweep all before them. I've said already, Judah gets invaded twice in Isaiah's lifetime, once by Syria and once by Assyria. Isaiah's disciples know that the Babylonians are going to invade and finally conquer Judah. And a lot of people around Isaiah's disciples are saying that they need an alliance with Egypt to bail them out. Little Judah and Judah's God look pretty powerless, pretty stuck in the middle, at the mercy of her neighbors. But what does God think of the situation? Verse 15 tells us, behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are accounted as dust on the scales. Oh, the nations might look high and mighty, but when it comes to God versus nations, when they turn up for the weigh-in, they don't even register a blip on the scales. God's scales just don't measure things that lightweight combine all the forces of all the members of the UN Security Council, and God says, verse 17, they are less than nothing. The United States, China, Russia, Great Britain, weightless. Next up, we get the idols. In Isaiah's world, idols have real power. They're central to the religions of all the surrounding nations. And if the book of Isaiah is anything to go by, they probably featured in the religious life of most Israelites. And they're much more than just lucky charms. They're the way to get power or wealth or protection from evil, victory in battle and success in business. People of the day take them very seriously. But Isaiah is very clear. They are man-made. They're dead. Just gold and silver and wood. And they can't do anything to help or to hurt you. They need chains to hold them in place. You need to pick your wood really carefully because, well, it would be really embarrassing if your god started to rot. And you need a sturdy base so that they don't move. They're powerless, worthless, and they don't even begin to be a comparison for God. Lastly, we get a look at princes. I mean, surely if anyone's in charge of the world, it's these guys. I mean, they rule the world, don't they? And in Isaiah's day, they like people to know it. One Assyrian emperor from not long before Isaiah's time wrote in his public records, "I am royal, I am lordly, I am mighty, I am honored, I am exalted, I am glorified, I am powerful, I am all-powerful, I am brilliant, I am lion brave, I am manly, I am supreme, I am noble." Now, to modern ears, maybe that sounds a bit overblown. Perhaps His Majesty watched a bit too much Oprah Winfrey. But these guys were feared. Some of them were worshipped. These guys had the power of life and death over hundreds of thousands of people. But how do these emperors compare to God? Verse 22 says, "God sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers." God brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness. The emperor thinks, "I am royal, I am lordly, I am mighty, I am, I am, I am." God says, "You are a grasshopper, and you're soon forgotten." I haven't told you the emperor's name for two reasons. One, I can't pronounce it. And two, you've never heard of him anyway. And that's exactly Isaiah's point in verse 24. The emperor was gone practically before he arrived. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely has their stem taken root in the earth when he blows on them and they wither and the tempest carries them off like stubble. He was a terror in his time, but he's a museum exhibit now. The God who made the universe is completely unrivaled by anything and anyone in the universe that he's made. There isn't a close second. There are no also-rans. His power and his wisdom are beyond anything we can really imagine. And that means that we should face Monday morning with a deep confidence and a healthy cynicism. A deep confidence because nothing comes close to rivaling our God. And a healthy cynicism because plenty of things pretend to. Your lecturer might seem intimidatingly smart to you, but she doesn't hold a candle to the God who made a trillion, billion stars and knows their names. Maybe we're tempted to feel that public opinion is piling up against us like a mountain of opposition. God thinks his scales are getting a bit dusty. We can be confident. Modern politicians might not have quite the same delusional opinions of themselves as the Assyrian emperor did, though maybe you can think of one or two who might. But they are sometimes pictured as having the power to seriously help or seriously hurt the gospel. And of course, under God, they can do some good and some harm. But this passage should really put them in their place. over in America right now, they're currently going through the process of selecting a new grasshopper in chief. Whoever it ends up being, he or she will be gone before you know it, and God will still be ruling his universe. Oh, the Monday morning world might call itself the real world. It might look like the real world. It might even feel like the real world. But it's really just an incredibly thin slice of the big picture that we and those around us have a really hard time seeing beyond. We should have a healthy cynicism about its claims. So don't get sovereignty amnesia. Or rather, treat your sovereignty amnesia to a regular dose of looking at what the God of the universe is really like. We need that constant reminder. And if you doubt that, look at how the passage is chock full of these rhetorical questions. Who measured the waters? Who created the stars? To whom will you compare me? Do you not know? Do you not hear? Isaiah isn't teaching his disciples anything that they don't know already. And chances are, I haven't said anything this evening that you don't know already. But they forget. And come Monday morning, too often I forget. We need to remind ourselves and remind one another of the awesome God that we serve. Why not maybe keep your notes from the weekend away and put a date in your diary to look through them again in a couple of months? I guarantee that you'll need the reminder at some point between now and then. But maybe you're thinking, you know, it's great that God has all this power and all, but I don't. God being powerful doesn't take away uncooperative bosses or difficult colleagues or depressing news stories. At the end of the day, yeah, okay, fine, maybe my boss is a grasshopper, but at least he's a bigger grasshopper than me. And that's where our second point comes in. Don't worry, it's much shorter than the first, but our second point here, remember the unrivaled power and wisdom of the Savior God. Remember the unrivaled power and wisdom of the Savior God. God's power isn't just something that he keeps to himself. He doesn't sit on a cloud looking down at all the grasshoppers without doing anything about it. God uses his unrivaled power to save his weak and downtrodden people. The power that made the heavens and the earth is on hand to save powerless and foolish people who trust in God. Look with me at the second half of verse 28. The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. The creator God has unlimited power and knowledge. But what does he do with it? Verse 29, he gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. He gives power. They aren't powerful. They are themselves faint. They don't have any might of them their own, but God gives power. He increases strength. And what are the results? Well, it says, even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. But they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Supernatural power and endurance. You can be the youngest, strongest, fittest person you like. Maybe you run long distance for a hobby, or maybe you serve with the elites in national service if you're Singaporean. But everyone gets worn out eventually. But those who trust in God and look to him as their savior have his unrivaled power on hand to keep them going. The Lord doesn't grow faint or grow weary. And by his power, those who trust in him don't grow faint or grow weary either. So, of course, I'm not saying that there aren't going to be hard times. We're talking about endurance here, about perseverance. But if you're trusting in God, you can safely let go of that sense of Monday morning, real world, doom and gloom. By God's unrivaled power, you can keep going, and you will. So the way to apply this point is really just to go back over what we looked at in the first point and remind yourself that in that scary moment with the boss, or in spite of the discouragement you feel when you read that article, God's unrivaled power is on hand to keep you going. By his power, nothing can stop you making it all the way to the new creation if you trust him. I've had a great weekend, and I hope that you've had a great weekend too. And tomorrow it's Monday, and whatever faces us when we get up, God's unrivaled power, the power that made the world, is still ruling the world and keeping us going until he completes his saving plan. Let's just not get amnesia.